Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly, the international parenthesis continues. England, Brazil, favourites get cut down to size as Dunga's men can only manage one goal against a team with more fringe players than the Edinburgh Festival. Fernando Duarte reports. Elsewhere, after France do more damage to green hopes than the US car industry, Pod asks, can Trapp pull off a miracle escape in Paris? There's the latest from Africa with yet more Algeria-Egypt drama, and they like each other so much they've made plans for another. All the rest of the World Cup qualifying news, your post and New Zealand. So devoid of talent, Simon Cowell could sign them up for X Factor, but they're going to the World Cup. A top Kiwi report. All of that on today's Football Weekly, the 15th most popular podcast in New Zealand. I don't know if that's true. That may not be true. We might be 14th. We may be 16th, but what I do know, listeners, is that on board today we have Sean Ingall.
Hi, James. I just want to take you up on your point about the US car industry.
Oh, right.
Because surely eating meat contributes more, you know, through cows.
Household pets as well.
And household pets than I mean, I'm not saying that the US car industry is great for the environment, but there are other
problems. Thanks for bringing that up, Sean.
So I've got my Morrissey Meat is Murder badge on.
You have, yeah. quite literally. Also on board today we have Paolo Bandini,
wearing my Meat is Delicious badge over
here. Yes, good for you.
Hi Hayding.
And also paying a fleeting visit to the material world from the realm of pure thought, Jonathan Wilson.
Hello.
Good. Now, England, once again world beaters in the group, but beaten by the world as soon as they stick their noses out of it. This 1-0 defeat to Brazil, how much does it mean, Sean Ingle?
It doesn't mean a great deal, probably. It was England's reserve side. It was more really a chance for the fringe players to try and stake their claim for South Africa. I guess Julian Lescott and Matthew Upson did okay.
Ben Foster did okay.
He did all right. But I think Wes Brown, Sean Wright Phillips, Darren Bent didn't. Particularly Ben, I think people have been slating him today. But no one really did a Gascon against the Czech Republic in 1990.
Yeah, I think maybe the question isn't, you know, what did the game mean, but what did we learn? And we maybe learned that Darren Bent shouldn't be starting for England and very possibly shouldn't even be in the squad really for the summer.
I mean, to be fair, I don't think Darren Bent is quite good enough. But also, I think you saw how important a Heskey or Crouch figure is to England's shape, that when they're under pressure, when they couldn't get the ball back, they had no outlet. And the thing I found really interesting was the way that John Terry said afterwards, Brazil, nothing to worry about. Wayne Rooney said, they gave us a lesson. If you watch Brazil, it's really hard to see why they're good. And yet, they have been good for 18 months, 2 years. You know, they've won the Copa America, they won the Confederations Cup. And I think they just hold the ball really well. And I think they press really well. And so when you're playing against them, it's really hard to get the ball. Mm. And so Rooney finds it really difficult because he knows the team hasn't got the ball. John Terry's sitting there thinking, well, you know, why aren't we doing more against this lot?
While we're nailing people, we should also nail Andy Townsend on ITV.
Sorry, who did I nail?
You nailed John Terry.
I didn't. I said it was a completely normal reaction.
Okay.
But if you would like to nail someone.
Well, if you're going to nail someone, I think it's interesting. Andy Townsend on TV said, we all know that Brazil's defence is their Achilles heel, which is one of the great myths, I think, in world football.
What are some of the other great myths of
what, in world football?
Of world football,
that for me would be number one.
The fact the Italians are good at defending, that would probably be one.
No, if you go back to the last few World Cups, four World Cups, Brazil have conceded 19 goals in 26 matches. Ooh. That's 0.73 goals a game. England have conceded more than that. Italy, a bit less. They've 15 in 23 matches. Brazil's defence is never as bad as some pundits like to...
Other pundits. Yeah. All right, well, there you go. Yeah. So basically what you're saying is a TV pundit resorted to a cheap international stereotype.
Which we never do on this show.
We never do on this show. That's for sure. Well, there you go. Meantime, what was the reaction in Brazil to this 1-0 win? Well, let's dial up our top chum of the pod, Fernando Duarte, who has been staying out there in the lap of luxury in a 6-star hotel in Oman, but yet is still depressed about the whole business. Is that right, Fernando Duarte?
Hello, kids. I'm driving somewhere in the mountains of Oman. I hope a cop won't see talking on a hands-free like a lunatic. But
you can talk on hands-free. That's okay.
That's fine. Yeah. But I'm talking to myself. I don't know if it's a crime here.
No. All right.
Seriously.
If it is, you might end up hands-free in a very permanent sense, as producer Ben suggests.
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed, to say the least. I mean, it was a second-string England side. We were basically obliged to entertain a bit more. But then again, that's Dunga for all of us, isn't it? Very pragmatic. He said that yesterday when people asked, well, we're going to play against Oman on Tuesday. It's not a very good side. are we going to do? Are you going to entertain? He said, well, my only commitment here is with a result. So basically, that says all, doesn't it?
It does say a lot. He's playing Oman. All he cares about is the result. It's just a friendly. So what's the reaction in the Brazilian press?
Well, they were a bit disappointed with the lack of chances, the lack of fluidity in our game. On the other hand, we played quite well in terms of shutting England down. Then again, it was England's C team in a certain way. I don't think some of those players are going to go to the World Cup. Actually, some fans were asking me, what the hell is Darren Bent doing in this team? Who he plays for? And I said, Sunderland. And they were just laughing, basically. People are disappointed, but then people are disappointed with Dunga. Fair play to him. I mean, he's making the team play, but we're not playing a fantasy game. Having said that, I don't think a fantasy game is something we can possibly play with the current crop of players. We don't have, like, 40 class anymore, James.
All right, well, Paolo's got a quick question
for you. I was just going to ask, Fernando, I mean, you mentioned the Brazilian starting it there. I was just wondering what your sense was being out there of how people in Doha were about the fact that England had sent out, you know, essentially a second-string team for a game that was this, you know, money-making exercise that was all about bringing over your commercially viable players. England weren't ultimately able to bring over all the players who were, you know, a big sell.
If we were disappointed, the locals were actually saying, oh, shame everybody got injured, but still Brazil and England, oh, you know, the stadium was full,
yeah.
Atmosphere was great. Having said that, it's really funny how Brazilian fans are quiet abroad. You know why? Because only middle-class people travel. So while you guys have organized ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, England, all we do is sing a horrible song that some TV station once decided to compose. So, for fair play, I take my hat off to the English supporters. Even though it was a very dull match, they were there doing the Great Escape songs, etc.
Terrific.
I mean, high-quality football.
Yeah, and nice to get the reference to the Second World War in, because that's still very much a pressing issue in terms of international football.
It's from the movie The Great Escape, isn't it?
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah, all right. But you were mentioning that it was England's C team. How many, Fernando, of the Brazil team that we saw on Saturday do you think will be going, will make up Dunga's first choice team in South Africa?
Well,
he's made his own great escape. Fernando Duarte, the mountains of Oman. Sounds like quite an adventure. Thanks, Fernando. I had a question here from PF10. We'll have to do that another time. Perhaps when Fernando's physically here in the studio
does
with us.
Does the show be pulled out? Because
who?
Fernando. It would have been interesting to have his thoughts.
He didn't pull out.
The cutout.
Yeah, cutout.
Because
yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear his thoughts on Diego. Well, his thoughts on why Pato wasn't picked as well.
Yeah. The two Ronaldos, Ronaldo. Adriano is top scorer with Flamengo. He's got the 19th of the season this weekend. I think that Adriano probably will be in the squad, but then, hey, what do I know? Should we move on then? You know, having been a meaningless friendly and all that, should we move on to the really important games? Games like Ireland-France. Now, there's 1-0s and there's 1-0s. What kind of 1-0 was Saturday's?
I think it was potentially a disastrous one for Ireland just because, you know, you look at their results and how often do they go away to a team like France and actually win. I mean, they might be thinking they're good enough to go there and get a draw, which is clearly what they were heading out for in the first place. So I think they basically, if you are watching the game, the first half, they really executed the game plan they wanted to. They were high energy. They were harrying France and they never really let France settle. And they had a couple of really good chances. I mean, Liam Lawrence was really unfortunate. I mean, actually, it was a superb block from Evra when you saw the replays. At first, it looked like Lawrence had basically spooned it with an open goal, but actually, Evra had come across and just got a toe on it after essentially just a long ball, which Kevin Doyle headed down to Robbie Keane. But, you know, Ireland didn't create many chances and they were a little bit unfortunate with the goal in that it was a deflection off the heel of St. Ledger. However, they also should have probably given up a penalty when Evra went down in the box. So it was a bit swings and roundabouts with that. You know, France in the second half moved up through the gears and they did look like a better side and Ireland just didn't really have an answer to it. And some of the Irish papers this morning have been talking about players being heavy-legged and the pitch being very heavy going underfoot, and that's why they tied in the second half. But ultimately, I think it was just a case of there wasn't enough ideas. You know, with Trapattoni, what he's been doing all along is you sort of live by this sword and you die by it, which is that now, you know, you've lived by let's stay in games, but when you find yourself behind, you haven't got a creative enough approach to
well,
win.
That's part of his own fault with Stephen Ireland and Andy Reid.
Well,
I mean, when you know, I think Trapattoni has largely brought this on himself. I mean, Ireland have a limited squad, but when you know when you are discarding the likes of Stephen Ireland, he doesn't fancy Andy Reid, and when you've got Aidan,
he didn't discard Ireland. Ireland discarded him. I think Andy Reid, fair point.
We had an interview in the Guardian this weekend in which Stephen Ireland spoke about it, and I think actually it sounded pretty clear from what he was saying that he wants no part of the Ireland setup, and he actually made some implications that seem much more fundamental about it's suggesting really that right through the setup there's some sort of favouritism towards the lads from Dublin was the sort of the subtext of what he was saying there. He was talking about coming up from Cork and not being happy about.
But if you read Roy Keane's autobiography, there's similar sorts of accusations made there.
So I don't think Stephen Ireland's real choice. Andy Reid, absolutely. You know, you look at it and you wonder why
he's from Dublin.
I don't know.
Andy Reid is from Dublin.
Is he?
Well, his dad's a Dublin taxi driver. So
there you go. Nice one. Good knowledge. Well, I mean, obviously, very good. All right. Well, Trapattoni's been doing the big yes we can business in the papers today and saying that he's won impossible matches before. He cites Fiorentina's 1-0 win at Wembley over Arsenal.
I was there for that.
Were you?
Gabriel
sure?
Battistino, yes. Certainly. Called it an absolute howitzer.
Mm. Right at the end. Machine gunned the crowd, did he not?
Yeah. He did, yeah.
Although I always felt like David Seaman could have stood up and blocked that. He sort of was bent over halfway backwards by the time the ball went over his head.
Absolutely. It was a similar sort of goal to Ryan Giggs' goal in 99 from that time. And Seaman, from about 98 onwards, had no bounce in his legs. Mm. And he made a famous save against Sheffield United. And people rave about it. But I think it's just Seaman had no legs then. He was so slow. He was almost in slow motion before he made the save. Great keeper, but I think his legs had gone just like Shilton's had in the late 80s.
I think it was Chris Woods as well. If you think about the goal he conceded in 93, cup final replay, the Andy Linegan header was down too low. And also the last Bohinen goal, Norway-England in the second goal in Oslo.
2-0.
I think there comes a point with keepers like that, though, where it's like they've been around so long, they've done such a service to the club that you don't want to let them go, and you're sort of like awkwardly hoping they're going to step aside at some point. And certainly I felt like that happened with Seaman at Arsenal.
Right. None of these players actually will be featuring in Wednesday's Stade de France clash between France and Ireland. Any chance, just quickly, for Ireland?
The bookies make France 14-1 on, so you'd have to put £14 to win £1 back on France.
Woof.
I'd say it's not impossible simply because France did even still look vulnerable at the back. The few times Ireland managed to get high balls in there, they didn't do it very much. One of the complaints in the Irish papers, and you know, again, it actually works the other way because there was a penalty that could have been the other way, but they complained they weren't getting free kicks around the area when their players were clearly trying to win free kicks around the edge of the area. And that's what they saw as their game plan was, let's get some set pieces and pump the ball in. They had one decent corner in the whole game, and that did cause a little bit of trouble. So you never know, but it's pretty unlikely.
Now, elsewhere, among the other home nations, Wales and Scotland took on each other in front of a small and select audience at the Millennium Stadium. Terrific goal from Aaron Ramsey, of course, to the light of Arsenal fans. Game over surely now for George Burley after that 3-0?
Yeah, tomorrow I think we may hear something. He's had a shocking record. People forget when he took over Scotland, they were ranked 14th in the FIFA rankings. Now, FIFA rankings, you know, I don't think anyone takes them too seriously. Scotland weren't a bad side, despite having a limited talent pool. I think now they're quite frankly dreadful.
They suck. I like Maradona's journalists. They suck and they keep on sucking. Yes. All right, then. Any thoughts on who will take over? From
Craig Devine's the favourite, about 3-1. But it's usual names, Walter Smith, Ali McCoist, etc. Jim Jefferies.
Right. All right, excellent. Now, that's probably enough for part one of today's show. Loads more international football to come, though, listeners, excitingly enough, including how much trouble Portugal are in right after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Jonathan Wilson, Portugal. 1-0 their victory at home to Bosnia-Herzegovina at the weekend. How much trouble are they in when they return to... Where are they playing the next one?
Zenica.
Thank you.
Bosnia
hit the woodwork three times.
It was a very strange game in that if Portugal won at 4-0, you wouldn't have said that was an absolute outrage because they had a lot of the ball, they had a lot of chances. But Bosnia had a great spell just before half-time and just before the final whistle, hit the bar, just before half-time, hit the bar and the post just before full-time. So equally, they could easily come away with a 1-1 draw. I do wonder if what might cost them is not having got the away goal, that effectively I think they'd probably have to win by two in Zenica, because I can't really see them keeping a clean sheet. So I think they'd have to win 3-1 to go through. So I actually think Portugal will probably be all right, but it'll be, you know, it'll be a great occasion in Zenica, to a very tight, compact ground. Yeah, they could play it in Sarajevo, a much bigger ground, but they prefer to play in Zenica where it's very tight and very... In hostile in a good way, very, very passionate. But I still think, yeah, having kept a clean sheet at home, Portugal, I think, will probably be okay.
Mm. Nani was getting a bit of a stick here on the pod on Thursday, but the reports indicate that he was Portugal's best player.
Yeah, played pretty well. I think any winger against Bosnia will do well because of the way Bosnia play with the wing-backs pushed high up. So there is space there for Nani, but he exploited it very well and, yeah, was very dangerous.
Mm. Now, I was just going to ask, Jonathan, did you see the Russia game? Because Russia seems to be in complete control towards the end, and now Slovenia have got an away goal.
Yeah, and 2-1. I think that away goal could be very significant. Slovenia actually did pretty well, I thought, the first half hour or so without really threatening, but I think they did enough to show that Ignashevich Berezitsky combination at centre-back, which we know it's hopeless. I don't know why they keep persisting with it.
And it makes me so angry, James.
In the past, they've got away with it because Ignashevich is actually a very good player. He's badly out of form now, all the hassle of CSKA. So I think Novakovic got joy against them. But then the real problem was when Semak went off. And I was baffled against Germany why Semak didn't play in that game. And I think Ozil got a lot of room for Germany because of the absence of Semak, who's the holding midfielder. Semak played for an hour on Saturday. So I wonder if Hiddink thinks at 33, maybe Semak's legs have gone a bit. And maybe that's why he didn't want to risk him against Germany. After Semak had gone off, it was very. We went both times. The score was 2-0. It was very obvious that Slovenia then came into it far more. How long will he be able to last on Wednesday? Why didn't he play that last half hour? Do Russia have anybody else to replace him?
On the Russian front, what a goal by Bilyetidinov, eh?
The first one, yeah. Or I mean, it was pretty bad defending by Schuller. Schuller was a bit exposed, but yeah, it was a lovely turn and a great finish. Absolutely.
No goals, Paolo, in Pescara, where Italy and Holland met. In a friendly,
yeah.
But there was one or two newsworthy incidents, not least the ankle ligament tearing injury to Robin van Persie. Has that injury been confirmed now by Arsenal?
It's been confirmed as a partial tear. It's not what they initially thought, which they thought it completely severed.
How long is he going to be out?
Apparently, going to be up to 6 weeks. What's been said this morning. So yeah, I mean, it's a huge blow to Arsenal. I mean, the Dutch coach was saying, oh, it's a big blow to the national side as well. And I was thinking, well, it's not that big a blow, is it? Because basically you're just sitting around until the World Cup playing a few friendlies. But yeah, he's out for 6 weeks, which is a blow for Arsenal because Bentner's already out and they've got, they've got some important games coming up. They've got Chelsea coming up. They've actually got a whole run, which I can't reel off the top of my head, but they've got a real run of games that are going to potentially
define
their
chances. And he's been their most crucial player so far this season?
Yeah, and he's, I don't know if he's been the most crucial player. Now, that'd be stretching. I think that actually they're in a fortunate situation. They've got a lot of very strong, they've got a lot of very good players up front now, and they can still bring in Eduardo to fill that role. But he's scored, I think, something like 8 and 11, something like now.
Right.
So he has been in good form, so it is a blow to them. And also, I know it sounds like a silly thing to focus on because he's not actually a player who does that much in the air, but it's another player who's over 6 foot who's out and he's probably replaced by Eduardo and maybe even Carlos Vela, both of whom aren't. And it's just another tall player out of the team.
For Mika Atomica suggesting that his injury effectively ends Arsenal's title challenge, perhaps being a little overdramatic. For Mika Atomica then posting in afterwards saying, oh, no, we do have other players who can slot in. But as you mentioned, Bentner out, and I think Walcott's out as well still at the moment, isn't he?
There's lots of other places in that team goals will come from in right. that sense, but it's a blow to lose a player that good at any time.
The other thing from the Pescara game was the exciting man who ran onto the field with basically the continuing of this call up Cassano campaign that's going on all across Italy, calling on Marcello Lippi to relent and leave a space in his side for Antonio Cassano.
Which won't happen no matter how much people protest, so you might as well. They'll continue protesting and he'll continue ignoring them. There was sort of, he was joking in the build-up to it because there was a report about, the Sampdoria president, Garone, said that there was a dark reason behind this exclusion and refused to divulge what it was. And so La Stampa speculated that Cassano had a fight with his son Davide, who's
with
an agent.
Davide Lippi, yeah.
Yeah, so
who?
Marcello in the build of the game was saying, oh yeah, he left him with a big bruised cheek, sort of slightly sarcastically. So yes.
Davide Lippi, though, was one of the guys at the heart of the Calciopoli scandal, of course.
Yes. But
Modgi's associates. But anyway...
I think that it's one of those stories that will bang on and on. And the thing is that Italy do need someone creative because they are desperately lacking creative spark. And Lippi likes to say, oh, well, there was lots of problems ahead of the last World Cup too, and look how that ended. But the thing is that there were problems off the pitch ahead of the last World Cup. The problems, that, the team was actually playing pretty well on the pitch. They had a lot of decent
Holland
results.
3-1 in Amsterdam in the build-up to.
Exactly. And there's none of that spark this time around. They're solid and they won't embarrass themselves, but you can't see this Italy team going very far at the moment because there's that lack of spark. And that's also why Totti is now beginning to say, well, I might consider coming out of retirement. And his wife was on TV this weekend saying, oh, I think he should come out of retirement. So you never know.
Well, Italy may not go far, but the invader with the pitch invader certainly did. He managed to go the entire length of the pitch unmolested by the stewards at the stadium there in Pescara, wearing a Superman t-shirt with on the back, call up Cassano. And he ran on and he was able to shout, stand in front of the Italy bench and shout, call him up, to Lippi, who was taking off his glasses and then claimed in the press conference afterwards, I didn't see anything, I'd taken my glasses off. And then he ran to the other side of the pitch and was kind of, one of the stewards put his arm around his shoulder and led him away. It was all very amicable because the entire stadium were there with banners saying, call up Cassano, let's forget the past, we're all fellow countrymen. In fact, even at the Italy-New Zealand match, the rugby game at, where was it, the San Siro, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was this weekend.
There was a banner there from the rugby fans saying, Mallet, the Italy manager, could you at least call up Cassano? So a bit of a national obsession, that one. Now, that's enough Italy, hey, let's move on. Uruguay are a goal up, with an away goal, in fact, in their playoff with Costa Rica. Meanwhile, in Africa, all sorts of exciting things are happening. Cameroon are qualified now with a 2-0 win in Morocco. Amazing stuff this, because they were bottom of their group when Paul Le Guen took over from Otto Pfister. Using Pfister had got them into a bit of a hole, but since then they've pulled their fingers out.
Yeah, and also, slightly following on the theme, Gabon have really been hit by the death of Bongo.
Yes. And there's no way we should be laughing about this, because it's a very serious thing.
The president of Gabon, Bongo, died shortly before what would have been the third qualifying game, which would have been Gabon v Cameroon in Libreville. Because of the death and the funeral arrangements, that game was then postponed. When they played again after the summer, Paul Le Guen had come into Cameroon, and Cameroon then won that game, which I suspect they wouldn't have won had it been played.
Well, he's won four in a row now to put them into the winning margin, which has taken to World Cup. You're very excited, Jonathan, about the Nigeria situation as well. They're also qualified.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic, I mean, I'm not sure it was a great quality game, but it was a fantastic, exciting game away in Kenya, in Nairobi. They needed to win, and they needed Tunisia not to win away in Mozambique. And after an hour, they were 1-0 down. On comes up with Femi Martins, scores within 2 minutes. Yakubu scores 3 minutes later, 65 minutes gone, 2-1 up. They're cruising through. Now, I saw Nigeria play Jamaica in February at Millwall. It's a terrible game, 0-0. Virtually nothing happened. Nigerian press, as rabid as ever, are going for Shehu Amadu, the coach. And he brilliantly, I mean, it's his third time in charge, so he knows exactly what's going on. Says, the mistake you are making is to assume that I wanted to win the game. Which, to be fair, what had been the mistake I'd been making. And he said, the point of today was it was a practice exercise. We were practicing retaining possession for in case we have a lead in the game and we need to kill the game. And I thought, actually, that's kind of, I mean, it's certainly a good argument. Whether it's a good idea to do that against John Barnes' Jamaica or not is another issue. But they then, 25 minutes ago, kill the game at the World Cup. And so what do they do? 30 minutes later, sloppy pass, they concede a goal. Panic. News then comes through from Mozambique that Mozambique have scored. Dario has scored for them. So Tunisia are not going to win. So Nigeria have 7 minutes to score to guarantee their world, to get a place at the World Cup. And sure enough, Obafemi Martins, little hooked volley over his shoulder. Ball goes incredibly slowly. One of those, you know how you want a real key goal, you want it to be really scrappy. You want it to be a goal where kind of it's just a real mess and the ball trickles in. Perfectly one of those. And Nigeria are there.
Jimbo, speaking of dramatic late goals, you were watching the Egypt-Algeria game.
We were coming on to that. Yeah, when it comes to drama in Africa, it doesn't come any more dramatic than that. Thursday, of course, in Football Weekly Extra, we were giving the full kind of background to the Match of Hate thing with Brian Oliver, who was there at the original Match of Hate. Although Hatenbaum says that the bad blood goes way back before that. 89, he mentions, is the qualifying game for the 84 Olympics. Egypt beat Algeria 1-0, and they went ballistic the same way they did in 89. Famous pictures of an Algerian player running after one of the band members and trying to attack him with a corner flag. He suggests, but politics here, that Algeria have always felt that Egypt didn't back them up in their fight for independence, and that's where the grudge originates. But anyway, so there is this tremendous ill feeling and that awful business back in 89. And then the two teams meeting again this time around to contest a place at the finals. Reports then of the Algerian Austrian team bus being attacked. They turned up at their hotel with three players with blood all over them, the windows smashed. But the Egyptians are saying that it was all a charade, that it was all staged by the Algerians. A very strange atmosphere in the build-up to the game. Incredible atmosphere at the stadium. We had 100,000 reports of people chanting Egypt, Egypt. And then, Sean, I think you saw the game as well. You know, the Egypt 3-1 down from the first leg, or they'd lost 3-1 to Algeria in the first game. So they needed 3-0 to go directly through to South Africa. 2-0 would force a playoff. They get the early goal with Amir Zaki. They spend the rest of the game attacking.
I don't think Algeria go out of the half in the second half.
And then they give like five, but it's still 1-0 and they're heading out. And 4.5 minutes into time added on. Finally, then, is it Emad Emetiab? Is that how I say that?
I wouldn't know.
Have you heard the commentary when the goal goes in? They get their second goal.
He's almost speechless.
Oh, they are speechless. It's just noises. But it's fantastic. Well, we're seeking out on YouTube that. They go absolutely crazy. And but, of course, all it means is they've got to have another game now on Wednesday, which is going to be an absolutely extraordinary match.
In Khartoum.
There was a Tintin in Khartoum, wasn't there?
No. Tintin never went to Khartoum.
Are you sure?
I love how quickly James dismissed that. That implies serious Tintin knowledge.
No, I mean, I really think he went to Khartoum. Maybe listeners know better. That's a challenge for you, listeners. Now, that's it for part two. Still more international football drama and excitement to come. In part three, though, along with your posts, so stay tuned for that. Exciting news here. We've got 50 tickets for a special Enjoy England event at Arsenal's Emirates Stadium. It'll be taking place in the very plush Diamond Suite and will start at 4:30 p.m. on Friday, December the 4th. The lucky few who win these tickets will be able to watch the World Cup 2010 draw live from Cape Town. That'll be followed by a special Football Weekly panel, including Barry Glendening and Kevin McCarra. Plus, we'll be joined by David Pleat, which will be nice. And it says here you'll even be able to ask us some questions, which we might answer. We will be videoing the event and putting it up on the site. For your chance to get hold of a pair of tickets, please go to guardian.co.uk/enjoy-England. Interesting, Sean Ingle. Almost as interesting as the fact that after 28 years of hurt, New Zealand are at the World Cup. Massive game over the weekend. Sean, you were watching it, I know. A 1-0 victory over Bahrain. Rory Fallon of Plymouth, of course, scoring the goal. Goalkeeper Mark Paston saving a penalty. And the All Whites are going to South Africa. Can't see any potential problems with that particular thing. Anyway, now, everyone's getting very excited about it in New Zealand, of course. And we're joined now on the line by Colin Peacock of Media Watch on Radio New Zealand. Colin, thank you for joining us.
Not at all. Good fun.
Right. Thank you for staying up late. I imagine it's hard to get sleep, though, at the moment, isn't it, with this incredible event this weekend?
Oh, incredible event. Everyone tremendously excited. I mean, some people thought they'd never live to see the day that a New Zealander appeared on Football Weekly Extra, but you know, it's happened in the same week that we qualified for the World Cup finals. It's tremendous.
Colin, I'm Sean Ingle. Some people are saying it wasn't the hardest qualification route New Zealand had to go through. You had to go past Fiji, New Caledonia, and the tricky tie of Vanuatu.
That's right. I was watching France play the Republic of Ireland, and you think, oh, you know, one of those two teams isn't going to go through. And if you were a supporter of either of those, you'd be thinking, well, this is hardly fair. Also, given the fact that Australia, from this part of the world, are also in the tournament. So you can't really expect to go through, can you, without playing a team that has ever appeared in the finals, I think. So it is rough justice in a way, but it's all to do with Australia deciding to go with the Asian Confederation and leaving this Oceania, well, I guess it's half a slot for Oceania, and really the New Zealand football authorities, who were previously, you know, absolutely useless and penniless, have targeted this. Since that decision with Australia was made, they decided that, look, no one ever comes to New Zealand to play us, so we will take this, we will assemble our team of journeymen from the second tiers of various leagues across the world, and Ryan Nelson, if he can make it, and we will play a few games across Europe. And they absolutely targeted this opportunity, and, well, now they've done it.
So are you feeling a little bit sheepish in New Zealand about going through then?
Well, not at all. You see, the funny thing is that when the first leg happened, which you were absolutely right on the pod, was an awful game of football, and it was a bit of an embarrassment, really. But after that game was hardly noted here. The TV news bulletins, for instance, the 6 o'clock news, on TV here. They didn't send any reporters. It was barely noted, and it was only when people finally woke up to the fact that it was, as they marketed the game, one shot for glory, that things took off. The tickets sold, and we realised we were going to have a full ground for a home international for the first time that anyone could remember, and then the opportunity just appeared. So. I mean, now it's like New Zealanders, they're not sheepish about it, but they've suddenly been confronted with the fact that they've got a team that can actually win internationals under pressure situations and get through to a major tournament.
Right, absolutely. So there has been a bit of widespread media coverage of the fact that you've gone through. Am I right in saying this is also because the rugby's not going so well?
Well, this is the really hysterical thing, is that just a few hours after the All Whites qualified for South Africa, the All Blacks played a test against Italy in the San Siro, of all places. And, you know, if I was live long enough to write the history of this turning point in New Zealand football, you know, I'd probably begin it at this point, in that you had TV pictures of All Black rugby fans, New Zealanders, who travelled to Milan. Oh, sorry, on this post you have to say Milan, don't you? Milan.
No, the city is Milan. The city is Milan.
Ah, okay. And they travelled there to, you know, they're sitting in the bars watching the game from Wellington at about, like, presumably 8 or 9 in the morning, and they were going bananas. And then they went to the rugby in the afternoon at the San Siro, was served up this awful dross by the All Blacks, sort of 80 minutes of collapsing scrums and kicking for touch, and afterwards their coach complaining about the Australian referee. And, you know, people are quite tired with it. You know, rugby here is overhyped, and a certain sportswear giant that isn't Nike has tipped millions and millions of dollars into the team. And the day before that rugby international, they were appearing doing live cookery with the contestants for Italy's Next Top Model, and being walking billboards for the sportswear brand. So, you know, people here are tired of it, and it's amazing to see even rugby supporters saying, well, you know, there was genuine passion, genuine enthusiasm over that football match, and, you know, they're keen on it and they want to follow that now.
Well, Colin, it's a fairy tale story, and long may it continue. Look forward to seeing the All Whites there in the finals next summer. Many, many thanks for joining us and for staying up, as I say. Very, very kind of you indeed. Interesting. So there you go, Colin Peacock. If you enjoyed that and you're in New Zealand, tune in to Media Watch on Radio New Zealand for more from Colin. And Ricky Herbert, of course, was there in 82, wasn't he?
He was in the squad, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they did it, yeah. Nice. Chuck Schick.
Confidence and authority, do you remember?
Well, it was on my piece of paper here. Chuck Schick says, what odds Australia, England, New Zealand and South Africa all getting drawn in the same group? That would be funny, wouldn't it?
But not possible.
Oh, right. Okay, because Connor.
It'll be done on a regional basis. Yeah. New Zealand will count as an honorary Asian team and therefore will be in the same pot as Australia. Oh. So you could, if England aren't seeded, but they will be, you could get South Africa, England and Australia or New Zealand.
Right, okay, Chuck Schick, stupid question. Right. Honduras Robot and Anish B both would like to know who we think will be the worst team in South Africa. Will it be North Korea, Honduras, New Zealand?
I'd say probably New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, North Korea are pretty good defensively. I mean, I saw both their games against South Korea, and I think they're very solid.
I think any team whose talisman is Rory Fallon has got to worry a little bit.
All right, then. Connor Wood, should Ireland join the Oceania Football Confederation? That's a thought for you. Interesting. Any other posts or business? Ooh, Slasher, who sent in a link for the French and Irish falling out over the box incident business. You see this? I presume this was all a joke. The French request for a box for President Sarkozy to see the game at Croke Park, and the Irish replying, how big do you want it? 30 centimetres or 60? how we chortled. I Want Curly Hair Too says, I saw on Sky Sports News last night that Darius Vassell has been evicted from his hotel in Turkey. I feel slightly sorry for him. And why does everyone forget to mention him when talking about English players abroad? Did you see this, actually?
I saw the news. I couldn't tell you any more than exactly that. Basically, the club's supposedly having some financial difficulties, and he got basically told that his hotel room was no longer paid for.
He's got nowhere to stay, apparently.
Thinking about coming home at that point, which you would if you had nowhere to stay, wouldn't you?
Right, amazing scenes when he signed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And quite amazing scenes, when he got kicked out of his hotel.
I probably shouldn't feel too sorry for me. He's been making, I would guess, between £5,000 and £20,000 a week.
If they paid him.
For the last decade as a professional footballer. There are lots of people in this country that, you know, or a lot less, and I'm sure he can easily take a flight back home. So that sounds really po-faced, doesn't it?
No, you're absolutely right to put things in perspective.
We should put things a little bit in perspective.
I think you're right, especially in the current economic climate, Sean Ingle.
Millions of people unemployed.
A lot of them in this very building.
Well, not yet, but yeah, but there will be soon, yeah.
All right, okay.
But just because he's made a load of money over the last 10 years doesn't mean the club can renege on his contract to him. See, part of that contract was giving him somewhere to live.
No, of course not, but I think the way it's been spun in this country is homeless Darius Vassell, you know, without a room is exaggerating things somewhat.
I just thought it was a curious thing. It's not often you see a professional footballer kicked out of his hotel because the bill hasn't been paid out.
Speaking of curious things, yeah. Since we always get gypped and we don't mention the MLS, David Beckham's LA Galaxy are into the MLS Cup final.
Yes.
After a 0-0 draw followed by a 2-0 extra time win over the Houston Dynamo.
Excellent.
That's as much as I can tell you.
The final is next Sunday, is it not, Paolo?
That sounds very possible to me.
It's in Seattle against Real Salt Lake.
Wow. Jonathan?
Yes, yeah, I believe it is.
All right, good. All right. And I think we've run out of top international news from around the world, except to mention, Paolo, that we had that little Christian Vieri theme running a week or two ago, and at the time it had been reported that he might be off to Brazil. And he said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'm retiring from football. Well, lo and behold, he's just turned up in Rio de Janeiro, and he's either signing for a second or third division team. But he says, football's going to help me through this depression I have, after the whole business of Inter sending private investigators after me.
I think you mentioned then about his brother. He did
Max Vieri.
Yeah, he did play football for Australia.
Football.
About half a dozen games or so.
Not cricket. All right, then. Super and indeed duper. And with that, we reach the end of a particularly vintage episode of Football Weekly. Many, many thanks to Sean Ingle.
Thanks, James.
And Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you.
And you, Paolo Bandini.
Thanks.
And producer Ben. And of course, Colin and Fernando. And we'll be back on Thursday with what must surely be the final word on the World Cup qualifiers. And of course, I look forward to what looks set to be an exciting weekend of club football. Make sure you join us then. For now, bye-bye.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.